Hello and welcome to episode 12 of D50 Shades of D&D. With me today are my cohorts, Rick.
Hey.
And James.
Hello, everybody.
And our good friend, Ed.
Hi there.
Ed joined us to run us through a BX adventure. We're covering
spoilers.
Dungeons and Dragons BX, or
now everybody
we like to call it, the Moldvay Basic and Cook Expert sets from 1981. Mm-hmm. And we kind of relive some previous lives, whatever.
Lives.
So what is BX in 1981? So there was a basic D&D before that, the Holmes box set, but it was a more of a setup for original D&D. And these basic and expert sets were kind of a self-contained game. We're reviewing them together because they kind of fit together into their own version of D&D that takes you from level 1 to 14. Does that sound,
Yeah.
And within the pages, you'll find a lot of familiar trappings. This was Holmes the first one that had race as class? Because original D&D actually didn't.
Original D&D did not, I believe. You're correct.
Yeah. So this continues with the race as class, with dwarves and elves, I think, being the only thing available besides fighter, magic user, cleric, thief.
Halflings,
and the halfling.
Yeah. Halflings.
We can't forget the hobbits.
Not hobbits. No, we can't. No.
Not hobbits. Don't sue us.
I'm being flagged by the legal department already. I see the red flags coming. Hector is our newest on-staff lawyer in our legal division. And
Michelle had me sign a lot of papers before I came on here. There was something about like filling my mouth with cement if I said it's the wrong thing. I didn't read that carefully, but...
Yeah. There's certain words that you can't say.
Gotcha.
So do not read it backwards.
Some of them rhyme with Bobbit. And Balrog, there's just certain things you can't say.
Okay, all right, yeah. She was very insistent on those things. I didn't say these
words. Since it came up, can we talk to Hector about, like, if he's going to put something in the microwave, like the popcorn. I mean, this popcorn stink.
Burning through, popcorn.
I mean, throughout the facility, that is uncool. So, Hector, I'm calling you out.
Yeah. That's right.
I can even smell it up there in the penthouse. It was really, really strong.
It was harsh.
Yeah.
Man, they put you in the penthouse?
Oh, yeah.
Wait, we have a penthouse?
You'll get a key eventually.
Wait, was one of the things I was not supposed to say? Shoot, I think that was on the list I wasn't supposed to say. Shoot. Okay. I mean, no, of course not. I was at the day's end.
We typically reserve that for like heavy hitters, like, Eric Bloat or something like that. So, yeah, you're a lucky guy.
The basic and expert set, they were.
It'll be fine.
They were released simultaneously, so this caused me confusion as a kid. So I got the basic and expert set and the player's handbook and the dungeon master's guide for my birthday, my 13th birthday. And so I thought you went basic, expert, advanced. I think a lot of people may have thought that.
Yeah, that's what
and
I thought.
I was completely confused, but I did get those sets. On my 13th birthday, I got up, I opened my presents, I read the basic handbook, all 64 pages, I do believe, from beginning to end. And then I said, Uncle Scotty, we're rolling up characters. I think I've told this story before, so we'll move on a little bit.
Uncle Steve did not approve. So, I mean, he was like advanced all the way. So he kind of looked down his nose at that whole basic stuff. So, we didn't play it a lot.
As did a lot of people. The misconception I always feel like I heard was like advanced was more deadly and dangerous. And from playing both, I want to say like basic is way more deadly than advanced. Yeah. I could be wrong.
I think it would be cool if we established, like, when you guys think of basic D&D, what version are you thinking of?
Moldvay.
Yeah, that's what I think of too.
So you guys are all BX guys? Even you, Jake?
Yeah.
I thought you would be Mensur. If anybody was a red box, I thought it would be you.
No. Well,
you're a little bit younger than the rest of us.
So the first set I got actually was, I think, roughly based on the Mensur set.
Yeah.
And
did it have a red box?
Weird boxes from the 90s.
It was a weird box from the 90s that was like a bridge to second edition, basically. And
as our listeners may recall, it may have caused a little bit of internal strife between James and his mother.
Oh man.
There was
I've heard the stories.
That was a TPK in a box.
TPK in a box. It was a very deadly module.
All right, so I'll step out and I'll be the outsider here. I usually am, but I'm a Holmes guy. That's my basic. That was the original set, that I bought, and I was also much like my Uncle Steve was probably kind of an influence there. And when DX came out, I thought, well, that's for newbies. That's not for old hands like myself. Yeah. So it was much later that I turned my interest towards, and BX had gotten, over the years so much, people would swear by it. So I turned to it many, many years later, and and now I'm proud to own, both box sets, but back then, no, I skipped it over.
So my first encounter with it, I didn't own it, but my first encounter with it was a copy of it at a general store in town, like tiny little town, 800 people. We had a general store and they had a copy of it. And all I remember is seeing the Earl Otis painting in the front and flipping through and just being like, oh, wow, all the tables and the cool typeface. But the painting got me. That pulled me in for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So Ed, how did you start out with, was it with BX?
It was, I'd heard it was back when I, this one time at band camp. that's initially there was, I had heard of Dungeons and Dragons, but I'd never played it before. And when I was a freshman in high school, there was another upperclassman who was like, yeah, I've got the box. And so he brought it. We looked at it. I immediately fell in love with the Errol Otis artwork on the front. It was just a magical painting, kind of like James was saying. And he ran a couple of encounters during lunch for a couple of days during band camp. And I loved it. It was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. He let me borrow the box set for about a week. And I rolled up a couple of characters and went through and just loved the artwork and the idea, because it was nothing like I'd ever seen before. I played games, but nothing like that, where it was sort of open-ended and based on your imagination and widely open to interpretation. So
this is true.
Yeah. And I loved it. But like a lot of people, I think in my or our generation, I thought that you went from basic to advanced. I thought advanced was a continuation of the basic and expert, which made sense. Basic, expert, advanced. By the names of the virtue of the name, it seemed like that would be the progression, of course, and it wasn't. But then I was also a little bit like Rick. Once I found advanced Dungeons and Dragons, I kind of looked down my nose a little bit at basic and expert. And I was like, oh, that's the simple version of D&D.
Yeah. And then
we got over later on. I
was like, and that was reinforced by the veteran players of the day. They're the ones that taught you to play, and so you kind of like assume that they knew what they were taught. There was no internet to go and say no these guys are full of shit, full of poop, but it was just that's the way it was.
But and not too long after I was introduced to basic through the Molvay box, then somebody had the Player's Handbook, first edition, and that drew me into that. So again, seeing that iconic painting drew me into the advanced world. And again, playing with older players or people who had been playing for a while, more experience, had that attitude of like, well, this is a much more sophisticated game than that basic box set.
I know that finding out that I was wrong about that my bias against the basic sets were unwarranted, have influenced me now, where like I was already playing 5e, had played 5e, had the hardcover books, and then these starter sets come out and I was like, ooh, starter sets. So of course I picked them up, because even though I had the hardcover sets, these days I'm very interested in a new way to present the game, maybe an easier way to look at the game. So and plus they were an amazing value. So I got both the first one was called the Beginners or like the essentials or the starter set.
The essentials was
after. Yeah. So these days, I mean, I'm all about that.
Edwin, you said you got basic and then you got the player's handbook for advanced. Did you ever combine the two? I heard a lot of stories of folks who had both and just assumed you were supposed to use them together.
I never did, simply because I think most of the people who I was gaming with at that time were just using advanced and never used basic. So they had all the books, and I quickly got most of the books except for the DMG back then, and we went straight to advanced. So yeah, we never really blended the two together, which, yeah, hearing stories now, a lot of people did, because they did feel that there was a continuation of the game, and they just added the elements all together and it became one large amalgam of Dungeons and Dragons. So, but we never did. Yeah. For whatever reason, like I say, and when I first started out, like I guess a lot of new players did, I really wasn't interested in being a Dungeons Master. I wanted to play the game. I wanted to explore it and make characters and do all that kind of cool stuff. So I had the Player's Handbook, I had Deities and Demigods, I had Monster Manual, I had Fiend Folio, but I didn't have the DMG for probably 2 or 3 years. And then I was like, I don't know how to run combat because it's not in the Player's Handbook. It's in the dungeon. I don't know what my saving throw should be because it's not in the Player's Handbook. So it was then I was like, well, maybe I should invest in the Player's Handbook. And then, of course, I got, not the Player's Handbook, the DMG. And then I got that and flipped through it 2 or 3 times. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the most amazing book that's ever been published in the world. So
I didn't have the Monster Manual. So I still use the monsters from the Basic and Expert set to run my AD&D games when we started that.
That's awesome. Very cool.
So
the beauty is that wasn't hard to do. You could do that with minimal fuss or problem or unbalancing the game.
Yeah, and it really looked like, to me, a stripped-down version of the same game. So things were fairly compatible. So there were actually things that maybe since I got them all at the same time, I didn't realize until today. Well, I'm sure the first several times I played Basic, I didn't realize it still did all the weapons do D6 damage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I would have thought if I was just... pulling out my memories, I would have thought that was gone by the time the Moldvay box came out.
In the expert set, they give optional, you know, variable weapon.
Yeah, damage. It's optional in the expert box, you know, but I jumped to advance so quick that I didn't realize some of the differences between basic, expert, and advanced. So let's look at those a little bit right now. We came across a couple things, that being one, the weapon damage. And how much time did we all spend about firing into melee? I think we all spent a bunch of time looking that up. And we actually could not find any penalty in the book for firing into melee.
So kids, fire away.
Fire away all you want. And beyond that, not only did it say, because I the assumption that I had is that they just say you can't do it. And looking online really quickly, it said, BX says you just can't do it. But actually looking in the books, after a while, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say you can't do it.
We couldn't
there's
find
no
it anywhere.
There's no chance to hit your friends. There's no, there's none of that, which is what I sort of assumed was the rule. But I think that's one of the things that has become the rules that's not the rules.
The closest I could find is... you could potentially say somebody in melee has cover, and there's rules for cover, but that's it.
So and another thing we came across when looking up thief abilities, so we were looking for find and remove traps. So there's part on one of the charts that says find and remove traps, but most of the descriptors and stuff we can find, it talks about removing traps. So I went back to my OD&D box and my Holmes box, and it pretty much just says remove traps. And finding traps was left up to you describing correctly the way you're looking for the trap. This version, the Moldvay version, seems lost somewhere between Holmes and AD&D.
Yeah.
And like they haven't quite decided which way to go with it.
There's a general rule that if you happen to be looking for a trap, you have a 1 in 6 chance. Anyone has a 1 in 6 chance.
Yeah, but and that is in the book.
But the thief has a 10% chance to find and remove. It says find and remove in the basic set, but it only says remove in the expert set. So it's a little confusing. The thief actually is worse at finding traps than the average character.
Unless you rule that the thief gets to try for the 1 in 6 and the 10%, if you're going just by the stats. But it also says you can only check for a trap one time.
Yeah.
You know what I would... You know,
I like the thought of the magic user going, there's a trap right there. Nope, there's nothing there. Nope, did you see it? I see it right there. No, I see it. Is it like a poison needle right there?
This
right.
is one of those cases where these days, if I was running this game and that came up, I'd look to OSE. I'd look to Old School Essentials and see whatever decision that he made, because I find that, you know, pretty much he has looked at all the different options and he has chosen the one that seemed to make the most sense. So that's what I would do.
Yeah,
I think James is looking that up right now.
Good.
Yeah. The great thing, Rick ran an OSE game for us for a while. And that was the great thing, is that all those weird, inconsistent, weird editing things weren't there and everything.
No, because they had chosen a consistent, like, this is what we're going to do. So right. whether you agree with it or not, it was consistent. But I didn't find really anything about it that I disagreed with. And I think that's why OSE is as popular as it is. And if you don't agree with it, good night. It could not be more dirt simple to do it the way you prefer. I mean, just be consistent about it yourself. So if you're going to do it that way, explain it to your players, do it this time, do it that time, and do it the next time. And, you know, more than likely, everything will be fine. The game will not break.
Yeah.
I think the basic sets like this, better than any other versions of the game, I think you can, you know, cut and paste house rules in without completely destroying the system. Because everything is fairly intuitive. I tend to think that this was one of the first really intuitive versions of the game, because AD&D doesn't look very intuitive. I know the Holmes basic set was geared towards beginners, but these sets, they look geared towards beginners and players that might just only use these two boxes for the rest of their gaming days, which they clearly can. I never encountered anyone that just stuck with the basic game. In recent years, I've talked to people that have, but I'm sure there were plenty. And I didn't even think of it as being a different game until all the Beckme stuff started coming out, basic, expert, companion, masters. And then I started to acknowledge it as its own thing. But even by then, it's not what I wanted to play. Important to note, these two box sets, I think, were the first ones you could find at Sears and a lot of local drugstores and Rink's department stores.
B. Dalton Books.
Yeah.
Walden
that's books. I think that's why I was so popular, because it was so accessible where the other stuff had not been. I had a question for you, Todd, when you said intuitive. As a 13-year-old getting this box set, do you think it's really that intuitive to read this? Because I think when I think of basic, it is so foundational for me of what my assumptions are about just role-playing games, not even necessarily Dungeons & Dragons, definitely Dungeons & Dragons, but it really, for me, set the tone, the parameters, the foundations of what I consider to be a role-playing game. And any other game that I play now, there's been some games where I've had a hard time getting my head around the system because it is different than Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
So I just think, is it, I mean, when you picked it up at 13, was it really that intuitive, or is it just because we have become so, people of our generation, you're much younger than I am, but is it because this is so foundational?
No. Are you sure about
being
that?
Nice. I'm a guest in this podcast, Rick. Let me have this. Come on, man. I'm buttering it up so I can get through the edit. Come on. My best stuff won't get on the floor. But I'm just wondering, you know, is it so much because this is so much part of our gaming DNA even? Is that why we're so, it's so familiar, so intuitive, because it's like, oh yeah, obviously that's this and this, and you add that. This is how it works. This is how it all fits together.
So I think even though I got so many rules wrong, after I read through that book, I knew what the game was supposed to, I feel like I knew what the game was supposed to feel like. It's like, this is how it works. So, and then I had to punch in the numbers after that. So I had the gist of the game after reading through the book one time. So even though to someone that grew up playing Life and Monopoly, the game doesn't quite seem that intuitive. I think after reading that book, I felt like it was more intuitive than I thought it would be before I read that book.
I understand that. Yeah. The it wasn't like trying to get through first edition Player's Handbook without any sort of basic knowledge of
right.
role playing.
The thing that was super intuitive to me that I thought was like the only edition I saw this in actually is like they're very explicit of their flowchart of the order of events in combat
yeah.
and like when missile weapons happen, when spells are cast, and then when melee takes place. And what was interesting to me was like for a long time I heard about battles where wizards would cast spells and then get interrupted. And it never made sense to me how that would work, except for in basic, it does make sense because they have to prepare the spell. They have to prepare the spell first and declare they're casting it before combat happens. Also, simultaneous initiative was also like fascinating to me. But
things like that, James, that take like a two page description in the AD&D Dungeon Master's yeah. Guide is like on you'll find it on a quarter page.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like distilled down to just what you need. Most base of what you need, even though as a kid, you're kind of like, well, I think this is right. I think a lot of times we did get it kind of right because when we talk back about the games we played, they do seem like we played the same game.
Yeah.
I mean, simultaneous initiative. That means you have to roll the same number on a D6. Right. What are the odds that that is going to happen?
Just how often is that going to happen for
especially,
you?
Especially, what, 5 times in a row, was it?
Yeah, it's not going to happen like 5 times in a row or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it happened every single time, every combat that ran. It was
every single one. And I swear, it was like, you're kidding me. What'd you get? 5. Are you kidding me? I got a 5. What'd you get? 6. Are you kidding me? Yeah.
Yeah.
So to blow the dust off our box sets, Ed took us through a bit of the Isle of Dread module. I would like to add that these box sets, they both came with an adventure module. They have dice. So if all you got was the box, the basic box, you could spend hours, weeks, months probably still doing the Keep on the Borderlands. There's enough months crammed in there that you can kind of wing it. And then with the Isle of Dread and the expert set, you have more random encounter charts, more stuff about wilderness adventures. It's like they really are very nice toolboxes as far as what's in there.
Yeah. Can I do an old man rant real quick?
Yeah.
I miss the days, kids, when a module was 30 pages, had a removable cover, and was paperback instead of being hardback and being a campaign and being much more expensive. I miss those days. And yep. I guess it's just because of, like I say, when I started playing the game and things like that, you know, you got an adventure that was the Keep on the Borderlands. And like you say, that's months of entertainment right there because it was a structure, but it wasn't a story. You know,
right.
situations that you could be put in, but it wasn't a story. Same thing with Isle of Dread. It was just a big island and go out there and find some. I mean, there is an overarching idea that you're trying to find this black pearl, which is mentioned in the letter that you find that the map's on. But really, it's just a wander around, as we'd say, a hex crawl these days. And yep. all the adventures that you see now, they are campaigns. They are stories. There's something, there's an overarching idea. There's a goal, things like that. And I just kind of miss the open-endedy, sandboxy, and less complicated style of adventure. And again, yeah, that's probably just because I'm an old grognard, but I'm okay with it.
I had to move, and my laptop was about to go dead, so I had to mute myself and move. But I was not able to object when kind of like old man rants are kind of like my thing around here.
Oh, sorry,
so,
sorry.
You know,
oops.
I'll let it go this time, but I'll just have to come up with another one. You know,
yeah. I have to see if you can find another thing to rant about. I feel confident you'll find another thing.
I'll tell you what. I'll give you your old man rant. I will do my older man rant later this episode.
So on earlier topics on finding traps, you won't believe this, but OSE, I just looked it up. Thieves have a 10% chance of finding treasure traps, as they describe it. And everyone else has a 1 in 6 chance of finding traps if they are looking in the correct location.
That ported over to OSC, as a matter of fact, because that came up in our OSC game where the dwarf is actually better at finding like room traps, whereas the thief excels at. So if you've got a dwarf and a thief in the same party, you're kosher. But if you don't have one or the other, it could come back to bite you in the butt.
Yeah, thieves are only concerned about treasure traps, as it turns out.
Yep.
Interesting.
Hmm.
But to me, that reads anybody can find a trap if they're looking in the right location, 1 and 6. Thieves specifically will just notice a 10% chance to just notice, even if they're not looking in the right direction, a trap that is around treasure.
Hmm.
Interesting. So just to make sure we cover the mechanics of the game a little bit, which I've been known to get a little bit of hate mail over. It is level based. It's very much like stripped down. Almost, if you take any,
Is it that one guy from South Carolina again?
This could be the guy from Bulgaria.
Okay.
So almost any edition of D&D that you've played can almost be stripped down to this. You know, the levels and the hit points, it's got it's like a complete game system, but it doesn't show you 300 pole arms. It has limited magic spell lists, but a lot of it functions like you expect D&D to function. Well, especially if you use the optional expert damage rules, where a longsword does D8, you roll a D20 to hit. You roll D20 for saving throws.
There are special rules for pole arms in the expert set, just nice. So that pole arms are not neglected.
It's still the classic D6 per side for initiative, which gives us a lot of ties, as we've learned tonight. And it's the basic classes of fighter, magic user, cleric, thief, no subclasses, and dwarf is just kind of a specialized fighter, and elf is a more combat-oriented wizard, and I think the halfling gets the short end of the stick and is not very interesting in these games.
Short. And I gave you guys pre-gens for this few encounters, and I rolled them up according to the rules in the book, which was 3d6 in order: strength, intelligence, wisdom, dexterity, constitution, and charisma. And that's why I think we had a elf that had a dexterity of about 6.
Yeah. And probably why I didn't have a missile weapon.
So, but what's really good about this edition is the numbers inflation is almost non-existent. You know, most things like the blessed spell just gives you a +1 to hit and +1 to damage. Your ability scores, so like I'm looking at dexterity, it maxes out at +3 on missile fire adjustment and +2 on initiative adjustment. So everything maxes out at about +3. So you're never rolling and adding +7 to your die rolls, or, you know, something that's very common even at first level in some current games.
Is that one of the ones we can't say? The world's most popular role-playing game? We can say that.
The odds are you aren't going to get a +7 at first level in 5th edition. I think +5 is usually where you can cap out. So actually, 5th edition, one of the things I do like about it is they kind of did away with a lot of the numbers of inflation that you get in 3rd edition.
They have a 5th edition of this game?
Yeah.
They do.
So I wanted to talk to you guys. We might have to do a whole episode on explaining how that 5th edition isn't actually the 5th edition of the game. It's like the 7th or 8th. And we might have to plot things in order and tell people what.
Oh, then we have to verge into Gamma World, because it really gets confusing with Gamma World.
I know.
Well, there you go. But do you count? Here's a question. Do you count Holmes as being its own edition?
It's almost a mini edition.
Right.
But is it, because it kind of bills itself as like a codification of OD&D, right? It's still the original game. It is how it's built in the book, right?
So we'll
it's
we'll
got have to some stuff that's unique to it, though.
I think we need to save that argument for our editions edition of D50 Shades of D&D. And we'll get back to that later. As I said,
addition for you math-averse people. Not be like, there will be no math questions. Edition.
He is sounding like a grumpier old man.
Oh, yeah.
So
Well, there's good reason for that.
He's kind of like the Walter Matthau of the 50 Shades of D&D.
Bad News Bears Malt.
So let's talk about
life. Say the Sunshine Boys, Matthew.
Yeah.
Walter Matthau. You take it. You know what? If it's Walter Matthau, I'll accept it.
You're fine.
So
down at the diner, expert edition means it comes with lettuce and tomato.
That's making me thinking of Ed actually worked with Tony Randall, but that's a big segue.
So, that's a big segue.
back to the show. Back to the D&D.
So, James, give me some of your likes about BX D&D.
Oh, so I like the thing. I think I already kind of hit on it a little bit, but the thing I like the most about Moldvay Cook is the kind of simplified flowchart approach it takes to describing, here's how you run an encounter, here's how you run wilderness exploration, which was another like fantastic breakdown that, I didn't know how wilderness exploration was done, but like they simplified it into a flowchart. The little rulings that they come up with that is like obvious, like, yeah, if you want to know how often somebody can do that, it's like a 1 in 6 chance or a 2 in 6 chance. I like all of those little like crunchy, oddly specific rules, but in a very simplified ruling sort of way.
Would you say that someone playing any edition of D&D or any shade of D&D would benefit from reading these stripped down descriptions?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think especially if you're a D&D game designer, I want you to read these because, you know, minus the fact that you have to flip between expert and basic, which I think OSE kind of really solved that by combining them. Other than that, like, I think it is a great example of simplifying game design because they were able to get a very playable edition with lots of like beyond the basic rules, ironically, in 64 pages, water combat, aerial combat, wilderness exploration, creating keeps and castles, all of that's in there in 64 pages.
Times two between the two box sets.
Yes.
So, Ed, what would you say that you like about BX?
A little cover. On James Knight.
The cover.
That's, well, okay, yeah, you're right. I do love me the Aerolotus. I actually have a background with the Aerolotus cover. I can put on Zoom. Like James, I do enjoy the simplicity of it, but I had forgotten how fast this game is. You know, we had a couple of combats and a couple of events, encounters happen, but it was really, really fast. And I have been in other editions where the combat can grind on and it's like a slog to get through the hit points. And I really enjoyed the speed of it. And I enjoy the simplicity of character creation. I enjoy that stripped down, quick simplicity. I've said that too many times, but yeah, just the simplicity of the entire system while still feeling complete. I don't feel like I'm missing anything from it. Now that could come from a sense of nostalgia because I can't separate my nostalgia for the game from what I like about it.
Right.
Yeah. But playing, you know, now I play most of the time 5e with kids, and 5e is not necessarily the easiest system for beginners. And I've found some ways to simplify that and make it a little more streamlined. But the way it has been simplified and streamlined is to make it more like this game. You know, it really take a lot of the design principles from this and apply it to 5e. So that I like that about it. Ooh, and so if your character dies, it only takes like 10 minutes to make another one. So
this is true. This is true.
And you can almost fit it on an index card.
Yeah, we oftentimes
you got to use both sides if you've got like a fifth level character like we did. But you know,
so in fact, looking in my box here,
Let the record reflect that Todd is showing to the Zoom camera an index card that has characters on it.
I have a whole stack of them.
Plethora.
A whole stack of them.
Of index cards.
I've actually run BX more in the last decade than I did in the first decade it was out. Huh.
That's probably true in general. BX has been ran in the last decade more than it ever was when it came out, I think.
I don't know. I would like to see those numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I forgot something I wanted to add that I love about this edition real fast is gold as XP. That is one of my favorite parts of BX and older editions is that there is strong incentives for like kind of the point of the game is getting in and getting treasure before the monsters kill you, because taking extra time, you know, balancing taking time versus treasure is a key part of the addition, and I really, really like that.
Which can make for a much more exciting game, because you need to take those risks to get the rewards. With milestone XP and more story-driven games, sometimes that element of risk isn't in the game. And I thrive on the risk element, and the hope and the probabilities are in my favor today.
Well, and everybody always, you know, goes on about older editions being, you know, for murder hobos and people who are just like really into the combat. But with XP tied directly to how much gold you're getting, you actually avoid fights more often because you're just trying to get to the treasure faster.
Now, in our short playtest that we just did that Ed ran for us, we avoided what, 3 combats?
At least.
We avoided the lizard man. The halfling-sized monkeys and the halfling-sized trash pandas, or whatever they were called.
The Phanatons, yeah.
Yeah, so that was a lot.
And we injected personality into several of our characters. Mm-hmm. James learned that backstabbing an ankylosaurus might not be the best idea.
Turns out there's armor back there.
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, if they were going to design a dinosaur that would be a bad idea to backstab. It's like, that's what they had in mind. It's the like the geniuses at Jurassic Park said, oh, you wait till you see this one. You
but know? Wait, what about all the thieves are going to backstab? Oh, just wait. We've got them.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, what about the plans to keep the dinosaurs from running amok? Oh, we didn't work on that at all.
We didn't have time to get to that.
But we're good if any D&D type thieves try to backstab our dinosaur. We're good.
Are they in for surprise?
Sucker.
Backup generator? No, we ran out of budget. Can't. Sorry.
Do you think Jurassic Park ever would have existed without the Isle of Dread?
Good question.
We need to do a deep dive on that.
Did Michael Crichton
play Dungeons and Dragons? Yeah.
Rick, tell us about some of your likes from BX.
Well, I mean, I admitted before that at the time that the game was, you know, came out and so forth, I kind of skipped it over. It was much years and years later that I turned to it and kind of looked for the, you know, of course, the secondhand market, and found a couple box that paid a little bit more than I was really comfortable with, but I'm glad I have them now. But I think the things that I like best are the way in which the rules are explained. It's not too dry. It's not like I've seen somewhere it seems downright like colloquial, but it's just a very easy read. Reading the rules, it's very easy to understand. The organization is very well done. The aesthetics appeal to me. The art crew that they chose to represent this one was Bill Willingham, Jeff D, Errol freaking Otis, Jim Rossloff. I mean, it's just like, oh my gosh, it's like a murderer's row of some of my favorite first edition artists. So I love the aesthetics. I love the way it's organized. I love the informal, but, you know, not too informal tone in explaining the rules. And finally, I like the way that the books are like 3-hole punched. Like, yeah. So you could throw them in your binder and that kind of thing. You could clearly sneak them to school hidden, like throw some notebook paper on either side of them, and you're good to go.
Your trapper keeper.
Yeah, your Lamborghini Trapper Keeper that everyone ever needs.
Just make sure when you're drawing, like, you know, your band logos and so forth, idly, like during class when you're supposed to be listening, you're not doing it on the sheet of paper that's directly on top of like your copy of the game book, or otherwise that's going to impress right into it. And, you know, I don't know, maybe that'll make
lost AC/DC on the front.
There, yeah, exactly.
Yes, yes.
Dude, that's pretty
awesome. We've covered so much of what we like. I'm just going to point out just this, what some people might think as trivial, that actually has a lot of meaning for me, and that is the Gateway to Adventure 1981 TSR Hobbies Incorporated catalog.
Yeah.
If you look in my copy, I have prioritized what order I wanted to buy them in. Gamma World is sitting at number 3. And it is also no coincidence that the guy that owns Gateway Games and More and has put you in the state-of-the-art Gateway Games recording studio was very inspired by the Gateway to Adventure catalog.
It still smells like cool. Burnt popcorn. Thanks, Hector.
So, and I still go through this every once in a while. I was glad that Deities and Demigods was number one on my list in this catalog, because that means straight out of the gate, I got the Cthulhu version.
Yeah.
And I got it before I even got my monster manual. But this catalog, it's like dreams were built around this catalog.
Now, I actually don't have that catalog in mind. I have like this two-sided flyer. One side has the Choose Your Adventure style books that they came out with and the Dungeon board game.
Interesting. You might have had a game store had you had the other one.
I know. See, that's and then I have this the complete series of fine TSR products.
Did you buy your box set used?
I did.
So
it probably isn't all original. That's what somebody has thrown in here over the years.
It could be tossed together. But then again, in interviews with Tim Kask, I know with original D&D, you might get a box set where it's like the fourth printing of one of the books and the third printing of another, where that's what they found and stuck together in the box. But that could have been reassembled by someone after the fact.
Yeah.
I would like to say we all have things that say first printing, and we were finding differences in our first printings. And mine's first printing, January 1981. That's what Ed says. Ed's has Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson credited as the creators of the game. Mm-hmm. Mine has no mention of Dave Arneson whatsoever. I think Gygax is in the special thanks. I know there's a lot of behind-the-scenes politics that went around all of that, that I'm sure there are entire podcast episodes elsewhere that you can find on those.
Mine's in German, so God knows what it says.
Right.
For our listeners that are maybe newer to the game or maybe younger, should we explain who Tim Kask is?
Sure.
Tim Kask was the first full-time employee of TSR that was not one of the founding members of TSR. Sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
He was the editor of the first 33 issues of Dragon Magazine.
Inventor of the Boule.
Yeah.
Right.
And a local Cincinnatian.
That's right.
Did he create the Dungeon board game?
No, that was Dave McGarry.
Dave McGarry. Okay, sorry.
Who is a saint of a man, and everybody, if you ever get a chance to meet him and his lovely wife, you should absolutely walk up and introduce yourself and play his board game at Gary Con or wherever you might be able to find it.
Which we have played his board game at Gary
Con. Oh, yeah. And
that story, Wham, that's all I was asking.
If you remember, Tom Wham took pictures of us playing.
Yeah.
He brings along a beat up old table to play it on. And before you like say, well, don't they have better tables that he could use at the facility? They do, but they're not Dave Arneson's old table from his basement where they basically created, you know, Blackmoor and the very first dungeons, as in Dungeons and Dragons, were run on that table. So it's a holy relic, and you should all go up there and roll your dice on it and enjoy the blessing to them.
Rick, why don't you give me some dislikes, or a dislike if you have a dislike?
Already covered, like, you know, my old, you know, and unwarranted biases towards it. It wasn't like my basics that was Holmes. I didn't feel that I needed it. There was that ingrained, the older crowd that basically taught me to play Dungeons and Dragons. I wound up inheriting a couple of their biases too. And so that was unfortunate. But I think that ultimately I still prefer, even though now I am a huge Dungeon Crawl Classics fan. Everybody that knows me knows that. And that also features Race's class. But
what is that you're talking about? What game is that?
Oh, it's called Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Not familiar.
Well, never we'll have to sit down. We'll have to sit down. Okay. We'll have to sit down and I'll play it sometime. Maybe we can devote an episode to it. Now, since I was so rudely interrupted, that also features Race's class. But I think ultimately when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, I'm like an AD&D guy. And so I like the idea of my, you know, dwarven clerics or
You can be a dwarf player in first edition.
Oh, that's right. I also like the idea of house rules, apparently.
I like the one I used to play, my gosh. Yeah.
But I can't. I guess this is a long, rambling way of saying it. I don't really have a dislike against it. I did go ahead and buy, you know, I already mentioned I later tracked down, bought both box sets. I like it. I don't, it's not the most exciting version of Dungeons and Dragons out there, but it's far from the worst.
So my only real, I guess, if you want to call it a dislike, the short spell lists. There are only 12 first level magic user spells. And although the really good ones are there, it just, yes.
Okay.
So just the 12. So if you have multiple magic users in the party, or if you love to play magic users, you're going to end up recycling a lot of the same spells. So AD&D, I believe, has over twice that many first level spells, maybe even 30, a lot of which might be considered by many people to be useless. But I do like the magical variety in the spell list.
For me, the thing that I probably dislike the most, it's hard for me to find a dislike because this is my favorite edition of Dungeons and Dragons by far.
Really?
Yeah, it is.
So at this point, I mean, Ed's just joined us, but I know Todd, we've established his favorite is Castles and Crusades.
Well, AD&D.
If we're considering all this,
right.
Mm-hmm. I'm a DCC guy, you know, and now we've covered James's too. Only took us 12 episodes.
Yeah, that's not too bad. Yeah, it is by far my favorite.
And Ed loves 4th edition, so one day we'll have him back on for 4th edition.
Oh my gosh, I could talk for literally minutes about 4th edition.
I think 4th edition, to be fair, gets a bad rap. It was a fun game. I steal things from it all the time. The monsters were a lot of fun and had some cool abilities, and I steal stuff from it all the time. But anyway, things I dislike about this edition, the biggest one for me is just having to flip between the two books. And this is why OSE really is super great, because it is just the two books put together. So
if TSR would have put together almost like a cyclopedia two sets of rules.
What is that? That's more Beckme.
It is Beckme. Yeah, I was gonna say it's not
or Beckme, because I don't think there was any E in it. It was just Beckme.
Yes,
there the immortals on the end.
There's no immortals in. I believe they're mentioned, they're referenced, but they don't include.
But it's not in the book. Okay,
I wasn't. No, I mean, but there's plenty in there still. It's everybody should have a copy of the RC.
It's really cool. But the thing about that rule cyclopedia is it's overwhelming to me. Like the small booklet nature of this for running D&D, I think I really, really love the simplified version of it.
Tonight we looked up several things and we found the answers really quickly.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So flipping between the two books is one of the only things that I would draw a negative. The other, I guess, it's not a negative, but I think it's funny as a negative, is that back then they even had same problems we have today of characters doing clever things like, well, my new character inherits all of my old character's stuff. And there's a ruling in that on page 13 of the basic book. If the DM wishes, a player may name an heir to inherit his or her worldly possessions upon the death of the character. The local authorities will, of course, take 10% in taxes before giving the inheritance to their heir. This heir must always be newly rolled up first level character. This inheritance should only occur once per player.
D&D probate court.
so even then they were
is there a table for that
probate court table always, that's
Ed, every time. Ed, do you have a dislike?
I actually do. I was actually going to jump in though. One of the things, and I actually found it on page X3 in the expert book, it says if you want to, you can cut these books apart and put them in order in a three ring binder, and that's why I think the pages are labeled B number for basic and X number for expert.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to chop your book up and put it in the three ring binder to put all of the movement, all the combat, all the spells together, you can do that. I would be interested to know, did anybody ever do that?
Oh, man.
I didn't.
And is that why the box sets cost so much now?
Well, yeah, that's an ancillary question. Why is that? Why you can't find any of them? Because they've all been chopped to pieces. But yeah.
I would buy if somebody had a listing on eBay that they had done that to the two books. I think, yeah, I would buy that though. I just,
no, there's got to be one out there.
If it was in a Trapper Keeper, yeah, that would, like, with, like, I don't know.
Yes, that would be like awesome.
Something, yes, on the, please, front. My dislike, and I had forgotten about it until I read the basic rules again. Don't like magic users in this one, because magic users are nerfed, to use a term the kids like these days. As a first level magic user, you get one spell, you wear no armor, which is sort of classical D&D, and you can only use a dagger. That's it. Yeah. And you have awful combat abilities. Even in advanced, they let you use a quarterstaff and a dart, still with your one spell. And in this one, you can only use a dagger, because I looked at that three or four times. And I understand within the realm and the scope of the fictional world you're in, it's like, well, you start out as very weak and you're going to become extremely powerful by the time you hit 14th level and things like that. And I understand the point of, like, that's why the wizards and magic users don't rule the world, because there are so very few of them that make it that level. However, the reality of playing the game, why would someone want to, if they knew better, why would they want to play a first level magic user? You, yep, are a liability rather than a help. You know, the fighter, everybody else has a role to play, and the magic user does well, but it's definitely the cast forget, and now I'm going to stick you with my pointy dagger that I'm not very good at. You know, even at fifth level, I mean, the magic user had 12 hit points and a dagger. You know, it's like, oh, okay.
So the starting magic users get gold just like everyone else, that they have nothing to spend it on. So we always had the magic user always seemed to be like the bank for the rest of the party. But I also like the idea of buying like six daggers. Right. And then once you've used your sleep spell, you're the dagger thrower.
Yeah. I mean, that would be the thing to do. And you still have a crappy chance to hit, but you have more than one. You're just like, come close to me and I'll point you. And I guess clerics
don't get spells either at first
level. Yeah, not even at first level. I'd forgotten that, but there are no first level spells when you're first level cleric. I also think that this version of D&D, maybe to mitigate that, is very much into hirelings and retainers and hiring people to go with you. So you could, as a wizard, if you have a lot of gold and nothing to spend it on, hire a guy to stand in front of you. So you're not, you know, yet another person to stand in front of you to absorb some of that damage or be a bit of a meat shield that you can then reward when you become a massive, powerful fifth level magic user.
A friend of mine who used to play in a mega dungeon version of BX I ran used to say the first item of equipment a wizard should buy is plate mail, and then hand it to somebody really dumb.
Not so, bad advice for a first level basic expert wizard. That's the only big dislike that jumps to my brain. It's just when I was trying to make the characters, like, oh my gosh. So
talking about first level wizards and such, I think is a good segue to Rick's magic missile segment.
You
have a theme song for that, Rick? You should, like, the audio production department should get on a, like, a little catchy tune every time you do your magic missile.
James and I have been collaborating, like, you know, like, when we can. I mean, you know, he's busy, I'm busy, but when we can, we get together, and he's
I don't know if you guys know this.
The singer-songwriter, he's kind of like the instruments guy. And so,
Rick doesn't like to brag, but he can do a rendition of Don't Cry For Me, Argentina.
Ed, I asked you.
Not a dry seat in the house.
When he's done. I asked you.
That's amazing.
See, I almost feel like I should, like, no, I'm not going to go into it now, because you know why? I got to talk about magic missile.
Okay, good.
All right, so in this game, magic missile gets kind of a boost in the sense of it's like all the other weapons, it does 1d6 plus 1, as opposed to what I'm used to, the 1d4 plus 1. And then the range is 150 feet. It's an auto hit, just like magic missile should be. One of the big differences about the BX magic missile is the fact that the duration is listed as one turn. And what I believe that means is, so the magic user can precast a spell. Like, you know, if you know that because the like the thief has heard noise and you know you've got foes on the other side of the dungeon door, you can go ahead and cast magic missile now. So when you're in the midst of combat or something like that, you can go ahead and let loose with the magic missile at that time without any further casting. You know, you just got to let it loose. But that means that, you know, you can have it ready and be walking around with it, ready for it to spring for 10 minutes, if I remember correct. And they also do the, you know, for every, like, I believe it's every 5 levels, you can cast 2 additional missiles. So, for example, at 6th level, you can cast 3 magic missiles. You can target them all with the same target, or you can split them up as the magic user sees fit.
Duration, yeah. I didn't notice that on a lot of spells. I'd forgotten.
Well, that's what I'm here for, James.
Very cool.
So, Ed, what would you steal from BX for a more modern game or a different edition of D&D that you're running or any other game you happen to be running?
If I was going to steal anything, oddly enough, I think I might steal D6 side initiative rolled every round.
Yeah.
It's simple. It's easy. It kind of maybe takes away a little bit of the special abilities of a thief type character with a high dexterity, if you're using sort of a fifth edition type dexterity bonus to your initiative. But I just like that. It's simple, it's quick. Like I said, we had many simultaneous combat. So everybody got a chance to do something. The monsters got a chance to respond and, you know, do some damage, but then they were out at the end of that turn, so, or that round, because round and turn are different things.
Right.
So yeah, I think I would steal that. And I've heard people using that in fifth edition to great success. So I think that would be the first thing I would look for, just for that simplicity's sake.
So the thing that I've stole for many other games are the adventures that come in these boxes. Wow.
Yes.
I've run the Keep on the Borderlands using Castles and Crusades. I've run the Isle of Dread using other games. So, because the adventures themselves, there's so much in there that you can just riff for days on adventuring. And the encounter charts in the Isle of Dread are absolutely fabulous.
And that's the strength in my old man rant. That's the strength of those two adventures, that they are so sandboxy, open-ended, but they are so confined in that you're literally on an island. You can only go so far, but within that island, you have everything from a dragon to an ankylosaurus to rock baboons to a hippogriff to there's a little bit of everything. Of course, there's all the civilized natives who are south of the big stone wall, and there's pirates, and there's, you know, you could, I guess, do just about any kind of wildernessy D&D game you want. And then you've got the Central Plateau with Taboo Island and all those. So yeah, it's so versatile for so many things.
And really, the old modules, you see a lot of it getting converted to 5th edition D&D. When you were playing 3rd edition D&D, you would see it converted to 3rd edition D&D. You know, you don't necessarily see as many 3.5 adventures converted to 5th edition D&D or even 2nd edition converted to D&D. But, you know, we have the OAR volumes from Goodman Games. On Drive-Thru RPG, you can find 5th edition stat updates for, I think, several old school D&D modules.
Yeah.
And I think they're great for converting. Rick, what would you steal?
Well, it's kind of specialized, but I think for funnels, Adventure Club Classics, I think I would steal the All Weapons Do 1d6. As is in funnels, when you get, and this is only for the occupation weapon. So, you know, in DCC, you start as a funnel or you play a zero level character, and you might have like a rolling pin, or you might have a frying pan, or you might have, even you might luck out and have a sword or a spear. But it's essentially, do you have a D4 weapon? Do you have a D6 weapon? Or do you have a D8 weapon?
Right.
With overwhelming majority probably hovering between D4 and D6. So I would just simplify that and say that, you know, your occupation weapon when you're a funnel character does D6. And that means, like, you know, if you ever like thought it would be cool, like for your character to have a whip or something like that. But then you look at the whip in typical D&D stats, and it's really underwhelming. Well, this would be your chance to have a whip that actually does some decent damage. And you could carry that forward through into your career so that, you know, that whip would always do that D6. But should you find another weapon, you know, once you become a first level character, or whatever, not so much. It would do whatever the, you know, the listing does. So it's your one chance to get a weapon that does. Now, if you got like a sword or a spear, you're going to want to toss that the moment you level up, because clearly, you know, they'll do like a D8 or better. That would be the very specialized thing that I would steal for Dungeon Crawl Classics. Probably wouldn't work for, well, I guess it could work with any form of Dungeons and Dragons, but I had DCC specifically in mind.
James, what would you steal?
Oh, so hard. There's so many things that I have stolen in the past. Reversible spells are pretty fantastic. I like all of the little like crunchy rules of like, you know, whether doors are stuck or like the, you know, 1d6, you know, one in, you know, whatever chance kind of rules. I like the rules for retainers. I've stolen that before. The strongholds rules in expert I've used. Yeah, I like all of the little crunchy bits. I've added those to games like Morkborg or some of the roll under kind of like
Morkborg.
Borg, yeah.
Hey, clearly there was quite a bit of gap between our AD&D episode when we recorded it and when we when it finally saw like the light and was released. And we even did the Morkborg episode before that. But some of you might be interested to know that I actually supported the Pirate Borg Kickstarter, and I will be receiving a hardback copy of Pirate Borg and the PDF as well. So I might not be the crotchety old grognard that I thought I was.
There you go. Opening up. See, this podcast opens up.
See, I've got layers.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, but then there's also the fact that it was a Kickstarter for a game.
Oh, I can't turn that down.
I'm just saying.
You mean I give you money and you give me a game? Where do I sign up?
They have things called stores that do that too, but it's like specifically the Kickstarter thing, I think, draws you like
a believe me, I games, it doesn't matter where they come from. I will
now, I have to say, I was rather jealous when I saw your Marvel game.
Oh, let's yeah.
That was kind of cool.
Yep.
So, Rick, real quick, when it comes in, I will run Orkborg for you, which is a Morkborg version with.
Of course, it is. Orcs, I'm sold. That sounds like I even said with Morkborg. I mean, it's like despite my feelings about the way the game is presented and so forth, it really was lost on me. But I said if James Smith came packaged with it, it might be my favorite game. So anytime you want to run it, I don't care what kind of Morkborg, Porkborg, you know, I'll play. Absolutely. Well, maybe not pork, because that sounds weird.
So I'm starting to get the stink eye from the producer, and he's starting to make those hand motions. So I think it's about time that we wrap
this up. Oh, those hand motions. I thought you meant something totally different for a minute. Okay. I got you.
So we would like to thank Ed for joining us. And
Thank
you so much for inviting me. I had a great time. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And I really, really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for running.
Yeah. I was glad to do it. I enjoyed running a game for adults for a change. That was nice.
Such as they are.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Well, yeah. But yeah, it was very nice. As I said, I didn't have to tell you every single time you wanted to attack what dice to roll.
Right. So I guess at that, we'll leave you with some advice from the Good Advice Dwarf, and that's never split the party.
Never fire into melee. Unless you're playing, you know, BX, and then it's okay.
Fire away, Jits. Everybody.
Tell them the folks at D50 Shades of D&D said it was fine.
Yeah.
Listen and check for traps, even though you may not be as good because you're a thief.
That's right. And I think we have an addition. Ed, why don't you share the one that we had from earlier tonight?
Monkey poo does a D6. That's the one you're talking about.
Yes.
Well, always avoid the monkeys.
Always.
Okay.
And their poop.
Thanks for joining us. Bye.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.